Shrink Wrap Radio number 410, a research-based view of mindfulness and health with Dr. Ellen Langer.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Ellen Langer, Harvard professor and author of 11 books and 200 research articles. We'll be discussing her latest book, Counterclockwise, Mindful Health and the Power of Possibility. For more information about Dr. Langer, please check our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ellen Langer, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me on.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you on the show. One of my listeners called my attention to your work, and I'm so glad that they did. First of all, I have to say, I was shocked to read in your bio that you're the first woman to have been awarded tenure at Harvard.
No, in the psychology department.
In the psychology, okay. Well, even so, I don't know your age, but it seems to me that regardless, Harvard was very late in the game in that respect.
Yes.
At the same time, it must have been very gratifying to you to be the one to break through that particular glass ceiling.
It was an exciting time. But that was in 1981, so a lot's happened since then.
Oh, yeah, so much so. Well, you've been researching mindfulness for around 35 years now. How did you first become interested in that topic?
Well, actually, I started by studying the other side, mindlessness. And several things led to this. The first was that people were always saying to me, "Are you always thinking?" You know, which made me think, "Well, what are they doing?" Then I would notice myself saying, "Excuse me," if I walked into a mannequin. Then the probably the biggest influence was when I left New York and came to be an associate professor at Harvard. And you know, you have a sense of Cambridge, full of all of these academics, that there's just lots of IQ points all
yes.
over the place.
Yeah, definitely.
And so I went into a bank, and there were several tellers, and that's the days when we didn't have cash machines.
Right.
And people were lining up to go to two of the tellers, and then there was another teller where there was only two people, and another teller where there was nobody. And this would never happen in New York. You know, people would immediately find the fastest way to make the exchange and leave. And so then I started to think that, well, this mindlessness is probably very different from intelligence. And I started doing research. The first experiment was not on mindlessness or mindfulness per se, but later I came to see it as an early study in mindlessness, where we had somebody ask for a favor, and they spoke the same words in each case. They just changed the order of the phrases, and we got very big differences. So people, if they take in information, they take in very little. Then there was another study, a very early study on all of this framing work that's out there, where we videotaped an interview between Bob Abelson, who was at Yale at the time, and I did this, I was a graduate student at Yale, and he and I had an interview where he was later labeled, the exact same videotape, he was labeled as a patient or a job applicant. And then we showed the videotape to people who were behavioral therapists or Freudian types. Uh-huh. And what we found was that the people who had been trained in looking at behavior, there was no difference regardless of what we called this person. However, for the Freudians, what happened is that when we called him a patient, the therapist saw him as having hidden this and latent that, and he was a mess. Whereas we called the same person a job applicant, he was seen as well-adjusted.
Ouch.
So again, it was clear that people were not fully present. The first study that I did where I actually called it mindlessness was a Xerox study where we had people go over to somebody at a Xerox machine. There's a series. These are a series of studies and ask if they can use a Xerox machine because they wanted to make copies. So they gave an excuse that meant nothing, right? What else are you going to do with a Xerox machine if not make copies? And or they didn't give a reason. And what happened was when they said, because I want to make copies, an empty reason, they were more likely to have their request met. We sent a memo to people that said, please return this to room 238. That's all the memo said. And again, we reasoned that if people were thinking about it, they would say, if the person who sent it wanted it, why did they send it? And that would lead them either to not send it back or to send it back with a little note or something.
Yeah.
And it didn't. They didn't. People returned it. I had gotten a letter from somebody shortly after that paper came out telling me that a friend of his put an ad in a paper that said, send $1 to, and then gave his address. And he made $20,000. So he wasn't offering anything, but people are so, you're going to say, oh, a dollar, that's nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was clear that mindlessness was pervasive, and it wasn't going to take that much for me to look at the other side. And when I came to the other side of the coin, mindfulness, for me, and from the beginning until the present, it's still mindfulness without meditation.
Yeah, let me jump in on that, because mindfulness has become a particularly hot topic of late, and mostly from a Buddhist perspective, and I gather you're not coming from that perspective.
No, so. I did some research on meditation back in the 80s, and I think that having written over 100 articles and 4 books on the topic, that I might have contributed to the frequency of the use of the word. So I don't think that everybody out there is using it in the clinical sense. But yes, lots of people do see it as Buddhist. For me, and the two aren't mutually exclusive, by the way. One can do both. But there are some people, I find, at least maybe just friends of mine, who have trouble sitting still for 10 minutes once a day.
Yeah.
So to sit still for 20 minutes twice a day to meditate was just not going to happen. And then there are people for whom some of this Eastern stuff feels too out there. And so they're not going to benefit from it. On the other hand, you probably have people who believe that their lives are so full of trouble that they have to do something extreme. And mindfulness, which I'll describe for you more in a moment, as I study it, is very, very simple. So if you think you're not going to get better unless you do something difficult, you're more likely then to meditate and be helped. And so mindfulness is the very, very simple process of noticing things. And as you notice things, that puts you in the present. And you have lots of pop psychology, saying, you know, be in the moment.
Right.
And that's fine, except that nobody is intentionally not in the moment. And when you're not there, you're not there to know you're not there. So how do you get there? And the way you get there is this noticing. We've all been taught to try to know as much as we can with certainty. And certainty breeds mindlessness. So everything is always changing. Everything looks different from different perspectives. But as soon as we think we know it, we freeze our understanding. And we miss all of what's going on. We can't take advantage of opportunities. We can't avert the danger not yet arisen. That basically of a state of mindlessness, which I've studied now for closer to 40 years, tells me that it is pervasive. Virtually all of us, almost all the time, are not there. Right. So when you know, if you went on a trip, this is summertime, lots of people take vacations. Very often these vacations are expensive. So they're going to go to some new place often, and they have the expectation that they're going to see all sorts of new things. Now, there are new things at home, which they've not noticed for years. So they go on vacation, noticing new things, and they have a good time. The essence of this mindfulness is this active noticing not only is literally, and I mean that literally and figuratively enlivening, it's the essence of feeling good. that when you're mindful, you're in the moment, you're aware, life is grand. Again, all you need to do is notice new things. One of the things I'm fond of saying is that you have lots of people who are in relationships for a long time, that you're in a 20-year relationship, and ho-hum, you know, the person bores you. And then you have people who are in jobs for the same 20 years, and they're bored to death. And as if doing something for 20 years, 10 years, 15 years, has to result in a certain kind of boredom. And I reflected on this and thought, well, I've never heard any of my friends say about their 20-year-old children, God, you bore me to death. And I think the reason for that is that with our children, we expect them to change. And because we expect them to change, we're looking for changes, subtle changes. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they stay interesting to us. Absolutely. Anything can be interesting. But as soon as we have this illusion of knowing, we hold things still. And we give up the present and let the past dictate our behavior.
Yeah. Now, the title of your latest book is Counterclockwise, Mindful
Yes.
Health and the Power of Possibility. And the title Counterclockwise comes from a seminal research study that you conducted early in your career. Perhaps
Right.
you can take us through that one.
Sure. There was a theory that I developed that I've been working on ever since that study, which we designed, conducted in 79 and first wrote about in 1981. And the theory essentially is that mind and body are just words. And if we put the mind and body back together, then wherever you're putting the mind, you're necessarily putting the body. Let me interrupt myself for a second. The mind-body problem, many people have heard of this. The mind-body problem is, how do you get from this fuzzy thing called a thought to something real, something material, the body? When you put the two back together, the problem goes away. It can explain spontaneous remissions, placebos, and a host of other things. So with that in mind, what we wanted to do was to take people who were old. These were men in their 80s, and that was when 80 was 80, not the new 60. I mean, they were really old. And we were going to have them live in a retreat for a week that had been retrofitted to be like 20 years earlier. They were going to talk about events from the past, but everything would be in the present tense. So for all intents and purposes, it was for them that 20-year earlier time.
Yeah, you took it back to 1959.
Right, right. And, you know, people don't realize when they read the study now that how difficult it was to set this up, because this was before Google.
Right.
You know, right now you want to see what was going on in 1959. You type in 1959, it takes 3 seconds. But we didn't have that luxury. At any rate, we had a comparison group that was also going to spend a week at the same retreat with the same props, doing the same things, except for them, they were going to be reminiscing for the week. So it was always the case that they were talking about the past. Okay. And because this was something novel for them, so it was mindful, even the comparison group, this reminiscing group, improved. But they didn't improve as much as the experimental group. The experimental group, their vision improved, their hearing improved, their strength, their memory. We took photos of them before the study and then at the end, and had people who knew nothing about the study evaluate them, and they were seen as looking younger as a function of the week being their younger selves. And so, interestingly, that work was, I helped the BBC put together a production with British celebrities, and it worked for them. Then it was conducted a little more recently in South Korea, and it worked there, and most recently in the Netherlands, where it also, I'm told, worked very well.
Well, I shared...
So there's very different cultures.
Yeah, I shared this story with my wife, and she immediately went to, well, how come nobody has commercialized this? This sounds like it would be a commercial opportunity of camp for old people.
Yeah, Well, I think some people have contacted me, but right now I'm so glad you mentioned that, that if your listeners type into this Mr. Google, LangerMindfulnessInstitute.com, you'll see that we're running these retreats all over the world.
Ah, interesting.
So we've done more work since that, not just dealing with age, you know, making people younger and more vital. We did a study that was very dramatic, I think, with chambermaids. What we did with chambermaids, as you know, are exercising all day long. Well, they don't see themselves as exercising. And that's probably because they see exercise as what the Surgeon General talks about as exercise for people who sit behind a desk all day long. It's what you do after work or before work. Okay, so we have these women exercising all day long, not seeing themselves as exercising, and we tell half of them, we show them that their work is exercise. We say making a bed is like working on this and that machine at the gym and so on. So at the end of this, we have one group who now change their mindset. They see work as exercise.
Fascinating.
We take all sorts of measures. We come back, I think it was 3 months later, I'm not absolutely sure, and we ask questions like, were you working harder? We ask other people, was she working harder? Did you eat differently? All of these things. There were no differences between the two groups. But we found that those people who now saw their work as exercise lost weight. There was a decrease in body mass index, waist to hip ratio, and their blood pressure came down.
Oh, my goodness.
All from simply changing their mindset.
That is startling. That's a startling finding, I think.
Yeah, and I think that, well, also, you know, everybody knows that placebos, well, maybe they don't know, they should know, though, that placebos are very strong medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And because placebos have been tested by people who have interest in medicine, putting it out on market, that when they run a study and the placebo does as well as the medicine, that's bad news for them. But that's actually wonderful news for us.
Exactly.
Right? And so this mind-body unity explanation, it can explain these placebos. When you truly put yourself in a healthy place, that's where all of you is going to be, your mind, your body, your fingertips, your elbows, and so on.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you also conducted another study with nursing home patients to see if they could be made more engaged and have a better sense of well-being if they were given the responsibility of caring for a plant.
And
I actually remember reading about that in my local paper.
Yeah, that was, I published that study in 1974, and that really helped usher in all of this mind-body research that the medical world now takes as a given. But at that time, it was extreme. What we did was we taught people to make decisions that people had given up all their decision-making once they entered the nursing home. We gave them plants to take care of so they had something to be responsible for. We gave them a pep talk. You know, you should be making all of these decisions and so on. And we had a tender, loving care control group. And we gave lots of measures, and that was sort of the coin of the realm at the time, questionnaires and so on. What was interesting is we went back 18 months later, and we found that twice as many people in the comparison group had died as in the experimental group, or just put it more positively, half as many who were given this treatment had died. And so that was fueling the fires for me of all the possibilities that exist for us, to which we're generally blind.
Yeah. Now, am I right that you are academically, you're a social psychologist?
Yes.
And what is it about you folks that you come up with these diabolically clever research designs?
I couldn't tell you.
It seems to me to characterize the field.
Yeah, I think the reason for that may be in part, most of us were trained to think in terms of two by twos. If people imagine a tic-tac-toe example where you have two different things. You have the presence or the absence of something on one dimension and the presence or absence of something on the other dimension. Now, the point that I'm trying to make, but not making well, is that most people think in terms of you do this, you get that. And you do more of this, you get more of that. And because of this design that most of us have been taught to employ, we look oftentimes for interactions. And that means you do this, you get that, but not always. And so being trained like that, I think people pay a lot of attention to the not always selves.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if I've elucidated anything with that, but you know, so be it.
Well, you're also looking very much at the social context and how that affects things, right?
Right.
And
yes.
And do you know if that plant study that you described, has that had an impact on nursing homes and what they do?
You know, it's since it's so much part of the culture now, it would be hard to imagine that it didn't have an impact. But it's very hard to be sure of influence. You know, if right after that, I got lots of calls all over the country from different nursing homes and said, can you put the program in place here? You know, then I'd be able to say to you, yes, that's what we did. Mm-hmm. But it's become part of the culture. We have a group of people now in baby boomers, for instance, who just won't accept traditional notions of age. And part of that is because they see they're not going to give up control.
Yeah.
As they get older.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't, in my moments of grandiosity, you know, I probably think all of my work has had enormous influence. Most of the time, I'm happy to say I hope that I've helped bring about some change.
Sure. Now, the subtitle of your book refers to mindful health. So talk to us about mindful health and what you're getting at there.
Well, you know, we've already touched on it, that in lots of these studies, in the early studies, right from the beginning, we teach people to be mindful, and that's mindfulness, again, without meditation, where you just notice new things, and we find they live longer, they're happier, they're healthier. And so I've been doing that work since the 70s. One of the things that I write about now, and that's in the Counterclockwise book, that I didn't do earlier on, was to recognize, so as I'm writing this book, I'm going to write about part of it about chronic illness. And I can't find a definition of chronic illness. Hmm. You know, do you have to have the symptoms 24/7? What if you have it three times a week, 2 hours? At a, you know, there's no definition. And that led me to think, what's happening the times you don't have the symptom? Do you still have the disease? Excuse me, and that leads to a very nice way for us to control our symptoms, which is if you're paying attention to when you have them, when you don't, and then you ask the simple question, why, or not even not have them, but they're less or greater, why now? In trying to answer that question for yourself, you're being mindful, and that will be good for your health, but you very well may have an answer. So let's say somebody has asthma. And they just assume, they're told by the medical world, you're always going to have asthma. It's all very implicit. And they don't think about it. They just assume that's their, you know, their lot in life. But if instead they became mindful in the way we teach, where they're noticing the variability in their symptoms, and they said, you know, when I'm talking to David Shrink Wrap, I need my inhaler. When I'm talking to Ellen Langer, I don't need my inhaler. Well, if they discovered that, then a solution is easy. I'm sorry, David. They'd have to stop talking to you or make the conversation with you more similar to the way they interact with me. So you see, the point is that when you notice that the symptoms are not always there, several things happen. The first, you feel better already. You know, take something like depression. Although it's true, chronic pain, we've done this with lots of diseases. But depression. You think people who are depressed think they're depressed all the time. No one is depressed all the time, and not to equal measure even the moments they are depressed. So you start noticing when you are, when you aren't depressed, And, gee, I'm not depressed all the time. And then again, you ask the question, well, why now am I experiencing this and not before? Or why, you know, and so on. You do the search. Again, the search is good for you. And you may come up with solutions. So that's part of, that's my dog.
That's, yes, it is.
That's part of what the new work is about. We have some of this mind-body unity work now with the common cold, with diabetes, with sleep. We have the attention to variability with multiple sclerosis, ALS, arthritis, so a host of diseases, and the data is starting to look very nice. The other thing that that we did that I wrote about in the Counterclockwise book, and I spend a lot of time thinking about language, to which many people seem to be oblivious. And one of the things, I was with a friend. Should I wait until she stops sparking?
Do you need to say something to her? Go
no,
ahead.
No, it's all right. It's all right. She's having fun.
Okay.
Anyway, so I was with my friend Eva, and Eva had just come back from Mass General. She had a very bad case of cancer. And I said, so how are you? And the doctors told her that she, you know, that the tests were great, that her cancer was in remission. And at that moment, you know, I thought, well, wait a second. If I had the exact same tests, they would tell me I don't have cancer. Why is it that I don't have it, but she has it in remission? Now, remission is a tricky notion. For people who have cancer and the cancer goes away, if they're told the cancer is in remission, they worry.
Yeah, in essence, they're being told it's going to come back, right?
Exactly. And remember that if we believe it, it's likely to happen. It's also the case that if you believe it's going to come back, you're going to be stressed. And stress is an anathema to health.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did was a study where we took people whose cancer was cured, and we asked whether they saw it as in remission or cured. And then we came back a year and a half later to these people, and those who saw their cancer as cured were happier and healthier on virtually all of the measures we took. A word to those who are listening who know somebody, if the cancer is in remission, you correct them and tell them it's cured. We do that with colds. You know, you get a cold, the cold goes away. You don't say your cold is in remission. You know, you see right. yourself as cured. Now,
yeah.
every time you get a cold, just as with the cancer, there are ways that it's similar, which is why we can call them all colds. But just as certainly, each cold that you get, each cancer that you get, is in some ways different. So if you attend only to the similarities, then you're likely to see yourself as in remission. If you notice the differences, can reasonably call it cured.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're not exactly critical of the medical establishment, but you definitely...
Oh, yes, I am.
Okay. It's stronger than I was going to say.
But I try to do it nicely.
Yes, nicely in your book.
No, I think that doctors know all that they don't know. And I think that if they would be more upfront with people, then people would take better care, at least start to become co-carers for their own health.
Yeah.
You know, that the medical world can only use normative data. And the studies are such where we're saying that most of the time, or much of the time, when we do this, this happens for most people. But they can't predict what's going to happen for any individual. And we're the keepers of that individual knowledge, and we need to get more engaged in our health care.
Yeah, I like the way you say it in the book, too, because we do tend to see doctors as all-knowing gods. But you underscore that there's so much variability that they're operating in nearly as much uncertainty or in the dark as we are.
Yeah. In fact, when I choose a doctor, it's typically based on their willingness to admit they don't know.
I have to ask if you've had any opportunities to apply these ideas about health in your own life?
Oh, sure. Most of my ideas come from my own life. You know, so that the early studies in the nursing home were a result of my, when I was young, interacting with my grandmother. And she was in a nursing home. She spoke of a snake in her head without realizing, you know, the trouble she was getting herself into. She was just lazy. She was saying, "My head hurts as if there's a snake in it." And because of that, they thought she was senile and treated her as such. And it was interesting to me because when I interacted with her, she was perfectly fine. And at that time, I didn't have this notion of the variability of symptoms. But that let me question how these stereotypes lead to lots of our diagnoses, misdiagnoses, and so on. My mother, in 1977 or so, not that it matters, had a very bad case of breast cancer. And the cancer had metastasized to her pancreas. And anybody who's gone through this knows that once it gets to the pancreas, the game is over. And then all of a sudden, so in the medical world, because they assumed she's going to be dead very soon, they didn't exercise her limbs. You know, it would seem like a waste of energy. And then magically, the cancer was totally gone. And, you know, a spontaneous remission, well, how do you explain it? And that's what I've been working on since, explaining it.
Yeah. At one point, you say we need to become health learners. Maybe you can expand on that a little bit.
Well, you know, that what we need to do is to be aware of our bodies. You know, if you sort of, I think the analogy I might use in the book is a car. You know, so a lot of us, I get in, I turn the key, I'm not listening, feeling anything, I just drive, and then all of a sudden there's this terrible screech, you know, that the brake pad is completely worn down. But if I had been in the car and been attuned to it, I would have noticed this very early on and then could have repaired the car without it costing as much money. So as with our bodies, that there are signs we have that we're just oblivious to. And it's like gaining weight. You know, people oftentimes don't notice it until their clothes don't fit. Well, you don't gain 20 pounds overnight. You know, if you're aware, without a scale, you can be aware, but otherwise use a scale. It doesn't matter. It's very easy to lose a pound. It's much harder to lose the 20 pounds. So if we tuned into our bodies, we're more attuned to our bodies, we'd be able to avert the danger not yet arisen.
Yeah, there are places where I'm reminded of the movie What About Bob? And baby steps, and you make the point, well, if you're overwhelmed by the idea of losing 20 pounds, could you lose an ounce?
Yeah, right. I talk about Langer's reverse Zeno's paradox. So Zeno was a philosopher who noted that if you always go half the distance from where you are to where you want to be, you're never going to get there. So let's start with an inch. So you're an inch away, then you're a half an inch away. Then you're a quarter of an inch away. Then you're an eighth of an inch away.
Right.
You're never. And I thought Zeno must be a cynic. So my positive version of this is there's always a step from where you are to where you want to be that you can take. So if you you know, have a tendency to eat 10 cookies, so eat 5 cookies. If you can't not eat 5 cookies, eat 2.5 cookies. And you keep going down. Everybody could give up a few crumbs.
Right.
You know, then you build yourself back up.
Yeah.
And it feels good being successful.
Yes, yes. Now, while not being a Buddhist, you are really Zen-like in urging us to constantly...
Yeah, my students call me a closet Buddhist.
In urging us to constantly look at the world with fresh eyes, to break through the automatic categories of perceptions that our brains have constructed. And I got some quotes from you, too. You say, "We apply convenient labels to most everything we encounter, blinding ourselves to alternative ways of understanding that would have made just as much sense and could turn out to be far more useful."
Right. As soon as we call something and we think we know it, yes. we don't pay any attention. Yes. You know, when I give lectures around the world on lots of this stuff, I often start by showing people how mindless they are. Because, you know, if I just said mindlessness is pervasive, everybody would think, yeah, their wives, their friends, you know, everybody else is mindless, but they're fully present. Because, again, when you're not there, you don't know that you're not there. And then I ask a simple question. I ask them, how much is one in one? And I can feel them rolling their eyes saying, oh, God, this is going to be a long hour. And, you know, then they dutifully say two. And I inform them that one in one isn't always two. In fact, if you're using a base two rather than a base 10 number system, one in one is written as 10. But beyond that, an easier one to understand is if you take 1 watt of chewing gum and you add it to 1 watt of chewing gum, one plus one is one. So we take the things that people think they know and show them that even those change depending on context. People like to hold things still, thinking that then they're going to have more control over their worlds. But holding things still costs them have less control rather than more control. Since everything is changing, everything looks different from different perspectives. If you're holding it still, you're just fooling yourself, and it's an illusion of stability.
But isn't that, in fact, the reason why our brains have evolved that way, that there's some adaptive value to this automatization?
So. Yeah, I don't think so. Uh-huh. I think that it's virtually always costly. I think that, now I don't have any data on this, so I'm stepping out on a limb, but we say, why is it that so many of us are mind, why are we taught to want certainties? And I think that what happens is this tends to maintain the status quo. You know, if we said, well, who made the decision on what criteria that, you know, the people who are teaching at Harvard should be teaching at Harvard? Who chose those criteria? What if we use different criteria and so on? And then what could happen if we did a sensible analysis? We say, yeah, well, sure, all lots of these other people could be filling those positions. So it's good for the people who have the power to lead other people to believe that everything is just as it should be. They should be on top and you should be someplace underneath. But I think that in all of my work, we find that across the board, making people more mindful makes them healthier, happier, more effective, more charismatic. Their relationships improve. Accidents become a thing of the past or very, very infrequent. Burnout makes no sense. There's no place for boredom, stress, and so on. That it's hard for me to think that there's an advantage to this mindlessness.
Okay.
Now, people sometimes believe that, well, you know, when I pay attention to this, I can't pay attention to that. So I want to learn the first thing so well that I can do it without paying attention to it. And then what you're doing is freezing your performance. So we do this with drivers. It's very funny. We have people learn how to drive in an absolute way. Before they have any experience with driving, they lock themselves in. Or play musical instruments or athletic. You know, everything that we do, we try to learn before we've had experience everything we think you need to know. Then we think we know. We don't pay any attention to the subtleties, to the context. You know, you're taught hold the tennis racket this way. Well, you should hold the tennis racket this way depending on the size of your hand, the size of the tennis racket, whether you've got a bruise on your hand, how you slept, whether your shoulder, you know, is a little, causes a little pain. And all of these very present moment things should dictate how you should hold the racket.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're taught absolutes. One in one is two. And so then we're not there. And accidents happen and possibilities for wonderful things are not met. And people are, an inordinate number of people are on antidepressants. See, when you're mindful, you're engaged. And when you're engaged, you're happy. So, no, I feel strongly that it's not an advantage.
You know, a lot of what you've been saying has implications for medicine and for psychotherapy. And I wonder, is any of the extensive training and workshops and so on that you're doing directed towards those audiences of doctors?
Yes, for sure. Yeah, we have, you know, at this point, workshops for everybody. For therapists, you know, what you have is person goes into a therapist's office. Well, as soon as they do, that's the label the therapist is going to use to understand your behavior, right? That was the patient job applicant study.
Yeah.
Now, the therapist, so in other words, you can be perfectly fine, and all the therapist would have to say is, gee, you're perfectly fine. Ignore your husband or whoever's telling you you're not perfectly fine. But now you get into the whole thing. The therapist, you tell the therapist some problem that you see in one way, and the therapist gives you, if it's a good therapist but not a great therapist, gives you an alternative way of looking at it. And because the therapist is the one in power, people tend to take that as the real one. So a simple, the simplest addition to for a mindful therapy would be for the therapist to explore with the patient multiple understandings. So when you think, you know, you have one understanding, it seems this is going to happen, this is the way this is, there's nothing to think about, and you just suffer with it. If you have multiple explanations, you come to say, yeah, I just don't know. Let me give you an example of this in a whole different realm.
Good.
I say to my students in this decision-making seminar I teach, tell them that for the last 40 years, I've taught a version of this course, and I've never missed a class. What is the likelihood that I'm going to show up next week? So these are Harvard students. They know they're not supposed to say 100%. So they say silly things, 98%, 97%, as if there's some calculation that they're doing. So people believe you can predict, which you can't. Then we go around the room. I ask them each to give me a good reason why I might not be here next week. And they have no trouble doing this. The first person almost always says, well, I've always been there. It's time for me to take the day off. Somebody else says that somebody needed me to take him to the hospital. My dog needed to go to the vet. They come up with very nice reasons. So that's like 15 people in the class. And then I say to them, okay, what is the likelihood that I'm going to be here next week? And now this close to 100% drops to 50%. So we tend to understand the world by looking back. And looking back, everything makes sense and is easy to predict because we're just post-dicting. It's already happened. So we try to see how it should have been that way, could have been no other way. Going forward is a whole different matter. There are a multitude of things that could happen. And if we had more confidence in ourselves so we could have a better appreciation of how unpredictable things are, then life would, you know, would turn out to be more interesting.
Well, I would love to see you design some research on psychotherapy to test out what you're saying, to have a group of therapists who are trained with this mindset. And do you think that anything like that might ever happen?
Sure. You know, I can't predict. you know, that it takes such a long time to do these studies.
Yeah.
Right now, we're doing so many studies, I can't say that I'll turn to it right away. But sure, I hope somebody does it.
Yeah.
But I think it's almost a Gedanken experiment. You know what that is? A thought experiment.
Oh, yeah.
That if you think of four things that could happen, how would you not believe that each one is less likely than if you only think of one thing? Right?
Right.
You know, so, but at any rate, if somebody wants to do the experiment, I'm happy to help them.
Okay. We do have a number of graduate students and undergraduate students that listen to this series, so somebody might get
okay.
A good...
Okay, well, it wasn't an empty offer.
Okay. you sort of have a running critique of science and psychological research throughout your narrative as well. Let's pause here to explore that a bit. You're a lifelong researcher. What are your observations about the strengths and weaknesses, the benefits and the limits of psychological research?
Well, as you said before, many social psychologists point out the non-obvious to people.
Yeah.
And in doing so, then they're making the public more mindful. So I think that it serves that purpose. It's the language people use to talk to one another. But do I think that experiments in and of, you know, that you do an experiment and what the experiment yields is a probability. When that is discussed, it's usually discussed as an absolute fact. And when you know something absolutely, you don't pay any attention to it. So in that respect, I'm potentially a little critical. I wrote something in the book that I don't remember fully, but I remember the word googliosaurus that I came up
with.
I said, so imagine that you're putting together a dinosaur, a googliosaurus. God knows where that came from. And so you have this whole theory worked out. And then you look under the table after years of putting this together, find a big bone that you didn't know was there. What is allowed to dismantle this and reconstruct it using bone? Is that we need to get tied to our theories and even as researchers to overlook alternatives.
Right, right.
Myself,
can you hear me okay?
Descriptive psychology that many study, and the psychology of possibility. Yeah, you can't hear me. Many people in the field are really trying to describe what is, and then they write the theories as if what is has to be. For the psychology of possibility, I start off with things that people don't think can be and see if I can make them happen. So, you know, with that early study we talked about, to improve vision and hearing, when is the last time you heard anybody's hearing improve without medical intervention? You know, so that an important part of that psychology of possibility is an appreciation for the difference between uncontrollable and indeterminate, that there is no research, there's no science, not physics, not psychology, no science can prove that something can't be. All it can prove is that the way we've tried to study it was unsuccessful. So to make it simpler, if you believe that your keys that you can't find can't be in the basement, you're simply not going to look in the basement, right? When you think you can't do something, you don't try to do it. When you recognize that you really can't know whether or not you can do it, maybe the keys are in the basement, then you're going to try out whatever the behavior is. Mm-hmm. So we have people doing things that you know, that they're not supposed to be able to do. And they learn to do them, then it becomes second nature, and then eventually the culture changes, and that becomes the new limit that people adopt, you know, which shouldn't be, right? Because perhaps they can go beyond whatever.
Yeah, we see that played out over and over again in the history of sports and achievements, you know, that people make in the Olympics and so on.
Right.
There was another study I found fascinating where you and your students looked into the impact on our lifespan of marrying someone much younger or much older than ourselves. Yeah, take us through that.
Okay. Well, so again, this is part of the mind-body unity idea. And this was archival data. So we didn't do any study. We just looked up lots of work that many, many other people had done and put it together in a novel way. And it turns out that if you have a spouse that's much older than you are, you are brought into that older person's life. You come to see yourself as older. For the older spouse, they have the reverse reaction. They see themselves as younger. And it doesn't matter what gender you are, that if your spouse is younger than you are, you tend to live longer. Another part of that paper was about uniforms. I had realized that clothing is a great cue to aging. You know, that if I'm in a store and I buy a miniskirt at 67 years old, you know, they're not going to let me out of the store, hopefully. So then I thought, well, people who wear uniforms are missing that age-related cue. So we looked up over 100, I might even been 1,000, but at least 100 different professions, those that wear uniforms and those that don't, controlling for education and income and all sorts of factors like that. And those who wear uniforms fare much better because they're missing that age-related cue. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't need to wear a uniform, not wear a uniform. You don't need to worry about marrying somebody younger than you are and so on. What you need to realize is the power your mind has over all these different aspects of your health and well-being.
Yeah, in fact, you cite research showing that our attitudes about aging have a bigger impact on our health than exercise, maintaining proper weight, and not smoking. And I go, really?
Yeah. It's a way to justify being a couch potato. No. I actually, and especially during the summer, play a lot of tennis.
I mean, yes, that's a very dramatic finding.
Yeah. No, I believe that we've barely touched the surface of what we're capable with respect to our health and well-being, of producing ourselves. And the joy, for me at least, is that to engage the principles that I describe, there are no negative side effects. You know, have you ever seen these commercials on television? You know, for this medication, whatever the medication is supposed to relieve, it tells you side effects may include a heart attack, your hair falls out, you know.
Yeah, death.
So it's nice that the mindfulness cure, as we can call it, doesn't have these side effects.
Yeah. Now, it also really supports a lot of sort of new age thinking in a way, and, you know, even far out things like The Secret.
Yeah.
How do you, you know, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, back when I did the first nursing home study, where the plant study, as it's affectionately called, that was cited by all the New Age people. That was very early on for the New Age. Now that New Age is old age. you know, I think that anything that is logically tight or research-based should have some influence. I think that one should learn this information and then go try it out and then mindfully decide whether it's useful or not. You know, so as far as The Secret, you know, I was asked about that when the book first came out. I was very happy that I hadn't read it, so I didn't have to really answer the questions, which I still haven't read it. But I think, you know, if The Secret is some version of if you think it, it will be so,
yeah.
I think there's great truth to that.
I'm sorry.
I don't think that, you know, that it's the case that if I think that when I walk out the door, there's going to be big bars of gold waiting for me, that there will be big bars of gold. But if I think that that I'm entitled to be successful and wealthy, then what will happen is I'll be open to all sorts of opportunities that I otherwise might miss. You know, my father, when I was young, we would be driving around New York City looking for a parking space, and I would point one out, and he'd say, "No, it's not going to be a space." You know, I would say, why are we driving looking for space if you prejudge it and assume none of them can be spaces? But that aside, that if you imagine now people, you know, and I have this belief, which is probably silly, but effective for the reason I'm going to tell you, that I always find a parking space. So I talk about, you know, I have good parking karma, whatever that means. Uh-huh. Well, you know, in the simplest way, what it means is that by expecting that I'm going to find a parking space, I notice things that my father, when he was driving around, was not likely to notice. Hmm. You know, so you have somebody carrying heavy bags walking towards cars. Well, you know, the person's not likely to go miles with those bags. You see when, you know, just a slight thing, there's somebody in the car that you wouldn't have even noticed, or the car moves, you know, the engine starts. And you'd be surprised at how much we don't see when we don't think there's anything to be seen. Mm-hmm. So the reverse of that is when we have the expectation that we will see something, we're primed to notice it.
I'm thinking of my little 18-month-old granddaughter and mm-hmm. how much she sees that we don't see. Like if there's a tiny little bug or an airplane in the sky, you know, that nobody else is noticing.
Yeah,
people
don't realize that the more we know, the less we know. Mm-hmm. You know, the more certain we are, the more we think we can see everything, the less we really look or hear or taste. Mm-hmm. And so there was a dramatic study that a colleague of mine did that's really a test of mindlessness. I did something myself on the same topic many years earlier, but not nearly as dramatic. So the wonderful study, he had people watching a videotape of a basketball game. And in the middle of the basketball game,
yes.
somebody dressed in a gorilla suit came on the court. Well, the interesting thing was that under certain conditions, that even though this gorilla is larger than life, people don't see it. You know, it's just not part of your mindset about what exists on a basketball court. And you need to have examples of that. I mean, when I find myself looking for something and I can't find it and later it's right where I looked, you know, I pay attention to those instances so that I can learn how to be more mindful. But if we don't pay attention to it, again, then we're missing. I've said in the past that I think most people are sealed in unlived lives.
Hmm.
And it's probably time to break the seal.
That's a good. That would be a good closing quote. But I want to.
That's why I gave it to you, David.
I wanted to ask you a couple other things. We're right near the end. Where do you see your research going in the future? For example, if a government grant for millions of dollars, if you receive that to spend however you like on research, what would you do?
Well. We're doing so much now, different diseases. We have a cancer study that I'm hoping that we'll get some funding for. That's another one of these mind-body entity studies, and that breast cancer, and we have one going on in India on prostate cancer. I have research. Actually, it's kind of fun because we have now the Langer Mindfulness Research Institute in China, the Langer Mindfulness Research Institute in India. Uh-huh. So I like that because I'll be able to find other ways of getting some of this done since people are not throwing money at me. If your listeners would like to, please know that I'm open to it. As far as what I would do with it, I have so many ideas that I'm not worried about running out of them.
Really?
And so I can't predict. I just know that having these ideas, testing them is great fun for me. I've done so much work now in areas where it really seems to matter that I can't imagine that I wouldn't continue with those.
Yeah.
You know, we have work in business, in education, and of course health, and just everyday relating. So there's not a topic that's not touched by this. You know, that if you're, once you realize that when you're doing anything, you're doing it mindfully or mindlessly. And so all of this 40 years worth of research says if you do it mindfully, the advantages are enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, so you're healthier, you're more excited, you're happier. People find you more appealing because we wear our mindfulness. You know, so we do studies where we have people being mindful or mindless, and we see who is found attractive and trustworthy and so on. We have research where we find that being mindful seems to leave its imprint in the work that you produce, and people prefer that work to those that are produced in the more typical mindless fashion, whether it's a symphony, a work of art, an essay, and so on. So I can't predict what I'll be doing. I can predict that whatever I'll be doing will be exciting for me.
Well, there's another good close.
I'm going to keep giving them to you.
So I think with that, I will say, Dr. Ellen Langer.
Oh, no, don't leave me, David.
This could go on for quite a while. I'd love to talk to you again. But I'll thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My great pleasure.
Many thanks to Shrink Wrap Radio listener Rob Canora for mentioning Ellen Langer in an email to me. I think that turned out to be a really great recommendation. I can't believe I had not heard of her previously, especially since her work seems to have been so influential and to have moved into so many different areas, and important areas at that. All the mindfulness discussions I've run across prior to this have been in the context of either Buddhism or mindfulness-based stress reduction. So it's very interesting to me that she's found her own, rather different and pioneering route into this topic. And I'm fascinated by the fact that her entry into mindfulness was actually via curiosity about mindlessness. Actually, I'm very impressed by her curiosity in general, by the way. Well, we all certainly have experience with mindlessness, I'm sure. The classic example is you're driving along in your car, lost in thought, and suddenly you realize you're not exactly sure where you are, or you may have even missed your exit on the freeway, but somehow another part of your brain was going ahead and completely taking care of driving the car competently. She gave a good rebuttal to my suggestion that our brain has evolved to give us the gift of what is known as automatization. Years ago, psychologist Robert Ornstein wrote about meditation as a way of overriding or breaking through this natural process. While acknowledging the value of mindfulness that Dr. Langer extols, I still believe that it is no accident that we are prone to having our brain pick up part of the load automatically so that we can turn our attention to other details. So my own thought is that automatization has both its upside and downside. Back in my early 30s, I was sufficiently concerned about my own difficulty staying mindful that I decided to put myself in a life or death situation where I would be forced to pay attention or perish. I did this by taking lessons to become a sailplane pilot. I knew I had to pay very close attention to everything the instructor was saying, or I might meet up with disaster. There was one element of the training that I thought was misguided, because I had the mindset that I should listen very closely and do whatever he instructed me to do. But then, as the training progressed, he began instructing me to do things that I should not do. He was doing this in order to see if I had really learned the lessons or if he could trick me out of not following them. I didn't think that was a very good pedagogical approach, but evidently it was standard operating procedure when he was in the military. But one of the things that he repeatedly warned me about was the danger of getting involved in a conversation with a passenger once I was licensed and losing sight of the landing field. Yeah, I thought, I'm not going to do that. But sure enough, sometime after I got my license, I was up in the air with a passenger and realized with a shock that I could no longer see the landing field. I couldn't see it because I had lost lift and sunk down low enough that there were now hills blocking my view. And of course, I had no motor in the plane. There was no lift available, and we were sinking fast. The only thing that saved me was fast thinking on my part and a decision to race up the valley to where I knew the road cut through the hills and to follow the road to get back on the other side of the hills where I could see the landing strip. The only problem with that plan was that I wasn't certain that I had enough altitude to make it all the way. In fact, I did make it, as you can tell, but not without getting royally bawled out by the owner of the airport. So that was an instance in my own history where my own mindlessness kicked in and I almost got a terminally failing grade. And there would have been no shrink wrap radio for you to listen to. Dr. Langer cited the study in which a video was made of one of her mentors and was labeled as either a job applicant or a therapy patient. And of course, the psychoanalytically trained subjects who saw the video ascribed all sorts of pathologies to the mentor in the video that neutral observers did not. That study put me in mind of a classic one from, I think it was the 1970s, and I believe the experimenter was Rosenhan. As an experiment, he checked himself into a locked mental ward with the presenting symptom of hearing a voice occasionally that said, "Thud." The point of this deception was to see how long it would take for him to convince the psychiatric staff that he no longer needed to be there. I don't recall the exact length of time, but it proved shockingly difficult for him to get out. Well, I felt very energized by Dr. Langer and by her book, and I hope that you did too. And if you decide you wish to purchase her book, as always, you can do so by using the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar.
My name is Grant Strine, and I practice clinical psychology in Havertown, Pennsylvania. After months of listening to Dr. Dave's spectacular interviews and noticing their positive effects in my personal and professional lives, I felt moved to offer a small token of monetary support. Not only did this extinguish any lingering guilt about not supporting, it boosted my mood for days, and I was so happy and pleasantly surprised to get a kind and thoughtful return email from Dr. Dave himself. Now I feel a profound satisfaction for being part of the Shrink Wrap Radio community.
Thank you, Grant Strine. I really appreciate your ongoing listenership and support, and I hope others will be inspired by your excellent example. I've heard from two or three of my listeners outside the U.S. that they are suddenly not receiving the most recent episodes that they had been getting through iTunes. I'm not sure why this has happened, but the fix is to unsubscribe to Shrink Wrap Radio in iTunes and then to resubscribe. I'm happy to report that we have three new transcripts on the site. We've got number 400, a war correspondent's memoir of yoga healing, with Brad Willis, also known as Baba Ram, and that's thanks to my intern, Eric Hanley. We also have number 398, Exploring Four Virtues, with Tobin Hart, PhD, and that transcript was done by Jan Derobert. And finally, we have number 89, The Secret Spiritual World of Children, with Tobin Hart. And that one is thanks to listener Jill Ebsworth. Thanks so much to these three listener/volunteers. If you'd like to volunteer to transcribe one or more episodes, just drop me a line to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, if you're not already an audiobook listener with a subscription to audible.com, then why not give it a try by taking advantage of their offer of one free audiobook of your choice from their library of more than 150,000 titles. I've been a subscriber for about the past 10 years or more, and I've always got one going. They have a large and growing selection relating to psychology. As a matter of fact, you can listen to today's guest, to Dr. Ellen Langer's Counterclockwise, as well as another one or two of her earlier books on mindfulness there. To get your free audiobook with no obligation to continue, just go to audibletrial.com/shrink.
Hi, this is UCLA psychiatry professor and author Dr. Dan Siegel, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Dan Siegel. He's not my next guest, but I'm proud to have had him on the show some time back. Now let's dip into some recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Samantha, who writes, "Hello from Toronto. Although it's been 4 years since our last communique, I want to let you know that I've listened to every single episode since. I now live in Toronto, but I still schlep my iPad around with me. I have acquired the app, wink, wink. It's been a tough," must be referring to the Shrink Wrap Radio app. "It's been a rough couple of years," she goes on to say, "and I must say your show has served as a bright beacon for me through the darkness. I rant and rave about Shrink Wrap Radio and find myself always dropping recommendations. For example, my brother immediately turned into a Dr. Dave fan upon my suggestion to listen to your podcast during a long car journey. Last night I received a lovely package from him. He had purchased a red t-shirt from your website for me. I look forward to wearing it proudly this Friday. Both you and George, although kilometers away from me, or kilometers away from me, have always been pillars of support. I am thankful that both of you exist in my life. Shine on." And that's from Sam, or Samantha. Well, I really got a kick out of this email from Samantha, as well as some others from her. And I do advertise Shrink Wrap Radio t-shirts on the site, but frankly, it's been so long since anyone ordered one, as far as I know, that I had totally given up promoting them. I haven't mentioned this in years, but they are there. I don't make a dime on them, but I do get a shot of joy juice in my brain at the thought of dedicated listeners out there helping to promote the show by wearing them. Hint, hint. You can see a very clever picture of Samantha modeling her Shrink Wrap Radio t-shirt by going to the store tab at shrinkwrapradio.com. There's a drop-down menu there, and you'll see a mention of the t-shirts. Hey, and while you're at it, buy a gross. Next, we hear from Tony in Australia, who writes, "Hi, David. I know you're a busy man, but I was hoping you could spare the time to give me a little advice. I've been burning through your fantastic podcast series, and I'm relatively up to date these days. I was wondering what podcasts you listen to. Is there anything you recommend listening to whilst I wait patiently for the latest Shrink Wrap Radio episode? Thank you once again for all your hard work. Your show never fails to fuel my fascination with the human experience. Keep up the good work. Thank you, thank you, thank you." That's from Tony Johansson, Melbourne, Australia. And I wrote back to Tony to confess that, you know, the shows that I listen to, the podcasts I listen to, are not many, and they tend to be tech-oriented. I listen to Leo Laporte talking about Macintosh things on MacBreak Weekly, and I listened to one about the iPhone this week in iOS with host Rob Walsh, and maybe a couple others. I like The Moth, and I like This American Life with Ira Glass. And I'm just not listening to psychologically related podcasts because, you know, I kind of get my fill of that. I'm reading about a book a week for my own podcast here. And so I'm getting plenty of psychological input in that way. And also, as I've mentioned, I'm a very dedicated Audible.com listener, and what I'm listening to there is Nordic noir, crime novels. And I make no apologies for that. And I suggested that Tony also check out my Wise Counsel podcast. I'm not producing it anymore, but there's a lot of content there that's still very relevant that people can go to at www.wisecounselpodcast.com if you find you need more from me. And back to the email bag, here's another from Australia. We hear from longtime listener Joan, who writes, "Hi, David. Thanks indeed for such an interesting interview in episode number 408 with Dr. Thelma Lobel, providing some wonderful examples to stimulate thought and discussion on this topic. I'm keen to listen to it again and pay close attention. I always hear more the second time through an interview." Me too. I'm glad you were able to incorporate a listener's question into the interview and in their own voice, too, a really interesting element of the show. With my best wishes and encouragement to both you and your intern, Eric, cheers from Joe. It's always great to hear from Joe. She was the major transcriptionist for a number of years, really. And she's taken a break of late, and I don't blame her. Always good to hear from Joe. Finally, here's one from Pete Myron in Chicago, who I had the opportunity to meet in person some years ago when he was out here visiting, and we discovered that we have a lot in common, really bonded. And he writes, "Hi, David, dear friend. I came back a little while ago from my morning dog walk, having listened, as I always do, to the latest offering from you. It was number 403 with Bill O'Hanlon. I got this wonderful nugget, which I will likely use in my next training with the Personal Growth Group facilitators on the 7th. It more perfectly explains and nuances an expression we use, quotes, hold a man's heart with compassion and his feet to the fire." And that's from Shrink Wrap Radio number 402 with Bill O'Hanlon. And he says that's 39 minutes and 32 seconds into the interview. Glad to have you call that quote out for us. Somehow I missed it, but it is a great quote. Oh, and then he's got an extended quote here from that interview. "All good change work, all good work in this world, when we are trying to make a change, which is so difficult at times, stands on two legs. One is acknowledgement and validation, that Carl Rogers stuff that you and I learned at the beginning of our careers. Just join with people. Don't try and judge them or try to fix them or make them change. Just be there with them in a compassionate, caring, listening, open, supportive way. But if that is all you do, sometimes people don't get challenged enough to get out of that brain groove, to get out of that emotional groove. So I think the second leg you have to stand on is the invitation to new possibilities and change. And so finding the artful way and the compassionate way to combine those two, to be right with the person, say, you don't have to change, I'm right here with you now, you're just okay as you are, and you want to come over here, you want to make this change, here's a possibility. Then people often move with you where you invite them to go." And Pete says, O'Hanlon goes on to compare the work with another person is similar to the sport of curling, where you sweep right in front on the stone. And he quotes O'Hanlon again, "You have to join with them right in this moment, validate them, treat them with respect, sweep right in front of the stone, sweep open possibilities, and then notice where the stone is moving and help them. You lead and follow at the same time," period, close quote. And he says, "I made some shortcuts for brevity's sake." He goes on to say, "Beautiful, so appropriate for us in our work with the men in the PGCS. We struggle with getting the second part of our phrase applied correctly." Now, he's referring to the men's group that he's affiliated with there in Chicago. It's a whole organization. What often happens is that new facilitators become too directive, trying to pull the calf into the barn, like Erickson's dad. The emphasis of the second leg being an invitation of opening possibilities with the action of sweeping with the man more perfectly captures the art form of how we want to be with the men in their change work. For me, just this one quote makes my monthly donation completely worthwhile, but I get so many other bon mots and inspirational items like this, like the Joseph Campbell correction, follow your blisters, wounds, period. So I am again finding myself deeply grateful for providing this steady stream of intelligence that supports my own bliss, i.e. men's work with victories. Big thanks, and that's from Pete. And then he says, P.S., if you remember that I invited you to the Wisdom Years weekend this May, I just came off that weekend, my first co-lead opportunity. The weekend was quite wonderful for the men and me. Please know I will be inviting you again, and I predict that one of these days you'll come and have an awesome time. So thank you for all of that, Pete Myron, Men's Group aficionado and leader, and I wrote back to say, well, I just might be coming one of these years. So with that, we'll wrap it up once again. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our relatively new message phone at 415-830-4014. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks again to Dr. Ellen Langer for a fascinating interview on mindfulness. My next guest will be marriage family therapist Linda Graham, author of the new book, Bouncing Back, and we'll be discussing resilience. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.